Today is the final Bible study service, not the final Bible study service, because we're going to continue, but the one on the series on Daniel. And I want to finish the book of Daniel today. It gets into some of the things that I find interesting and exciting of the end times. We left off Daniel 11, verse 35 before. For those of you visiting, I do this once a month to have a Bible study service rather than just the sermon. Since I have two churches every Sabbath, I used to try to do a Bible study after the afternoon service, the second service of the day. Well, it got to be too much hacking and dry throat, and there wasn't enough water here. That was the problem. Don did not put enough water up. No. it has gotten to be too much. Now, I can do two services. It doesn't bother me, because I have time in between, have lunch, drink something, and kind of refresh myself before going again. So that's why I'm doing that. It might be a little different than the church area you're from, but I make this so that I can get around and have at least one Bible study. And if I have questions, I'll begin the Bible study with questions and then go into the subject of the day. In another month, on the Sabbath of April 19th, during the Days of Unleavened Bread, we'll have Bible study, and it will be on something that is related to the Passover Days of Unleavened Bread at that time. But I want to finish Daniel today, and I think the timing worked out perfectly to get it done here in March before we get into the Spring Holy Days. Now, I'm going to what I did this morning, I'm going to go back and summarize a few things here as we start before I get into Daniel 11, 35 and on. When you look and study the book of Daniel, you can't help but notice there are certain things that continue on a certain thread through that book that he received either in interpreting a dream or having a vision that he saw and given the interpretation by Gabriel or another angel. But it's usually on the same subject, but with more information on that same subject each time, kind of progressively as we go from chapter 2 forward, as you will see, to the end here today. What do you see? Well, the first thing you see, the four kingdoms, chapter 2 in the dream Nebuchadnezzar had. And the fourth kingdom of, which is what, iron and clay, it's a statue of a man. He had two legs representing east and west, had 10 toes, all of that. This is just to recap a little bit. We don't have a whole lot more information in chapter 2, only to that extent. So a number of years later, God gave him a dream in chapter 7. And guess what? It's about the same subject, but now there's more information. And all four kingdoms, except that fourth kingdom, is unusual. Actually, it was in the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, too. I mean, because it was the one that had the two legs and the 10 toes. The other three, Nebuchadnezzar, you were the head, and the Medo-Persian Empire represented the chest area, I guess with the two arms, and the main trunk was the Greek Empire, wasn't it? And then from the waist on down is the Roman Empire. Then in chapter 7, they are compared to animals, leopards and bears and so forth. But the description of them is quite obvious what he's talking about. And then, of course, the angel tells him as you read further into the chapter of chapter 7. We have more information now on the fourth one, which is the most interesting in a sense that in this fourth one, it would have 10 kings. It says so, and it gives the interpretation there in the same chapter. And there's a little horn that accompanies it and will stay with it. This little horn is going to subdue three of those 10 kings. And, well, that's new information. Okay? And it's going to, guess what? That little horn is going to go after and attack the saints and is going to cause great persecution over a period of a long time. A time, times, and half a times. And in that sense, 1260, not days, but years. Years. And I'll come back to explain the 1260 and all the numbers as we get to the end of chapter 12. How do we know time, and half a time is 3.5 years, 3.5 days, or 1260 years? And I'll show you later when we come to that where I can do that. Then we come to something in chapter 8. We have the second and the third kingdoms identified, and that's where I'm going to actually begin. I said 11, but I want to go to chapter 8 because what is given in chapter 8 will come out in chapter 11. The first time we read about this that I'm about to get into is, which is the abomination of desolation. Now, just as the four kingdoms are spoken of on numerous occasions throughout the book of Daniel, so is the abomination of desolation. Now, that should cause us to pause and think, why did God have so much to say about the abomination of desolation? I think we probably could see why a lot had to be given about the four kingdoms and the breakdown. Now we see more information on the second and third kingdoms at the beginning of chapter 8. The second kingdom is, of course, a ram, has two horns. One horn is higher than the other. The Persians were stronger and greater than the Medes, who were in confederation with them. Then comes along this goat, big he-goat, which will turn out to be Alexander the Great. And he will ram into the Persian empire and destroy it within a very quick time, swiftly, within a matter of 3 years. But then Alexander is going to die, and his kingdom is going to be divided into four divisions. Now, before I get to that, I want you to look, I'll start in verse 9, chapter 8. And out of one of them came a little horn. This little horn is not the same little horn as you find in chapter 7. That little horn was associated with the fourth kingdom, Rome, okay? This little horn is associated with the third kingdom, Greece, or one of its divisions, as you will soon see when we get further in the chapter. And some of this I'll run through because we've already covered chapter 8, but just as a reminder, and the reason I want to is because you'll see that the abomination of desolation is quite an important topic in the book of Daniel, just as the four kingdoms are. That's why we should maybe look at that in terms, as we will see when we get to the end of chapter 12 today, the time of the end. Jesus Christ said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. How many times did Daniel speak of the abomination of desolation? One, two, three, four times, four chapters. Four chapters, the abomination of desolation is mentioned by Daniel. How many times are the four kingdoms mentioned? One, two, partially three, four. About four times, same amount, same chapters. Two, seven, part of eight, we're going to look at right here. Skip 9, skip 10, 11, yes, part of 11, the Greek kingdom divided. And that's about it. Then where do you go from there? The book of Revelation, chapter 13, chapter 17. What's there? More information about the same subject, the kingdoms. There, of course, the fourth kingdom, it's what is narrow, zeroed in on the fourth kingdom, and it calls that a beast. All right, but let's come back here for a second because I want to focus the Bible study here around the abomination of desolation, finishing up on that, and end time prophecy at the end of chapter 11. All right, and verse 9, and out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, east, and toward the glorious land, the land of Palestine or Israel today. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now, no human being can do that. The stars represent the angels. What that has to do with, the trampling down, that Antiochus Epiphanes would trample down the true religion, certainly, as we covered in the last Bible study in chapter 11. I'll just jump over to that in just a moment. Also, I want you to realize that what we're looking at here is dual. Because, yes, it does refer to Antiochus Epiphanes and the first abomination of desolation. It also refers to, in a greater sense, to the last one, the one Jesus Christ referred to. verse 11, he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. That is Jesus Christ. I don't know that Antiochus is the one that you could say fulfilled this one. He may in part, but we do know that the final one will, and this is probably explains why the final one, along with the little horn that's with him, will be thrown alive into a lake of fire in Revelation 19. There is something very incredibly evil for Jesus Christ to do something like that to these two individuals at that time. More than maybe we have fully grasped or understood. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Well, there's going to come a time when the daily sanctuaries are going to start again. The daily sacrifices. Certainly, Antiochus Epiphanes was in 168 B.C. He did it the first time. He took it away. It's history. Verse 12, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this, and he prospered at the same time. Now, the final one is going to do the same thing until the 3.5 years is up, and then all prospering will come to an end, to a deadly end for him. And it goes on here, mentioning verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And it says then 2,300 days. But your center margin will show it's not 2,300 days, it's 2,300 evening and mornings, or the sacrifices of the evening and morning twice a day. So that means it's 1150, not 2300. How that will fit into the end times, I'm not sure. The first abomination of desolation was not 3.5 years, it was 3 years. In the book of Josephus, it gives us the date when Antiochus Epiphanes set up that abomination and desecrated the temple, and it also gives the date in the same book there of Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, when the Maccabees, and 3 years later, had defeated the Syrian or Seleucid Empire, overthrew them, and cleansed the temple. And from that, of course, came two parties at the time of Christ. One was called the Pharisees, and the other the Sadducees. The Sadducees were the liberals who had gone along with much of the Greek Hellenization to be adopted into the Jewish culture. The Pharisees were those who wanted to return. They put a lot of, they were the backlash party. They added many human restrictions and so forth to the commandments that were not there before, that God never had given in the Old Testament, in order to try to return the Jewish people to the Jewish culture. And of course, they made it a real burden is what they did. And that's what Christ took exception to. All right, we see that. Then Gabriel comes, starting verse 15 on down, to give Daniel the interpretation. And you'll see in verse 20 that the ram was the Medo-Persian Empire. 21 was the Greco Empire, headed up by Alexander the Great. And he died suddenly after defeating the Persians. And as for the broken horn, verse 22, the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its own power, or with its power, not with the same power that Alexander had. The two that will be mentioned, which we've already covered, are the king of the north and the king of the south. And Seleucus Nicator was the founder of the king of the north, and out of Syria, Antioch and Damascus both. And it went all the way east beyond Babylon. But Ptolemy Soter the first had Egypt. And Egypt at that time included what today is Libya and all the way south to Ethiopia and throughout the Sudan. And he controlled quite an area. He also had originally the glorious land, Palestine. Now, there was the fight back and forth over that particular piece of real estate that took place. Now, before we go back to chapter 11, let's take a look at verse 23 on. And in the latter time of their kingdom, that is the four divisions of Alexander's kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. Now, that is dual right there. Antiochus Epiphanes the first time, and the one yet to come the second time. Verse 24, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall do, whose power then? Book of Revelation says Satan gives him the power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. In this case, you have a dualism there. The first holy people were the Jews. And the abomination, 80,000 were slaughtered in Jerusalem and 40,000 were sent into slavery by Antiochus Epiphanes when he invaded and took over Jerusalem in 168 B.C. And he was absolutely ruthless. The laws were set up that if anybody practiced circumcision on their male children, if anybody attempted to keep the Sabbath, they were automatically to be executed on sight. No trial. And ruthless as one could be, and the one to come is going to be like that as well. Verse 24, his power shall be mighty, and I read that. Verse 25, through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart. Oh, yes, he will, to the point that he is God. To the point that he is God. Now, you might recall in the last Bible study when we were talking about in chapter 11, what was on the coinage that Antiochus Epiphanes of the Seleucid Empire, he had coins that were minted, and on them, of course, was the title for himself, and he was a god, made himself as a god. What do you think about the one to come? Is he going to be lesser or more? Well, it's going to be more. Let me pick up here, and in the middle there, verse 25, and he shall magnify himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. In the King James Version, I'm using New King James, it says, in place destroy many. In peace destroy many. That he shall destroy many in peace, pretending peace when there is no peace. And that might be part of the way that he is able to gain full control, especially of the area of Israel today. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Well, is there any doubt as to who that might be? Well, chapter 9, which we're going to go to in just a moment, there are two princes that are mentioned there, one with a capital P and one with a small letter P. And we all know that the prince of princes is the one with the capital letter, Jesus Christ. He is the subject of the 70 weeks prophecy in chapter 9. But he shall be broken without human hand. Now that goes right back to Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2, that this fourth kingdom is going to be destroyed without human hands. And of course, by supernatural, the intervention of Jesus Christ. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And that is dual, because many days from the 6th century B.C. to 168 is, what was it? That's 300, 400 years. But then, 2,500 years, you might say, after from that period is the second time that we're looking at. All right, I just want you to see that, to know that here the abomination of desolation and the prophecies given about it, much of what is said is dual concerning that, and we need to keep that in mind. Chapter 9, the 70 weeks prophecy. I'm not going to spend much time except to go to the last verse, 27. Now, in the middle of the last verse, it says, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. What's he going to make desolate? Well, he's going to make desolate where the sacrifice of the evening and morning sacrifices are carried out. He's not going to make a piece of land somewhere out here in the middle of nowhere desolate. He's going to make something that is of religious importance desolate. Because we're talking there in chapter, in the 70 weeks prophecy, we're talking of what? Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. That's what it's, that's the location that's being discussed there. So here we see it once again. This individual is referred to even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate or the desolator. the desolator, yes, Jesus Christ is going to pour it out on that individual. All right, with a little of that in mind, let's go to chapter 11. Just to refresh a little bit, I skipped verses 5 through 20 because you can read that in Halley's Bible Handbook. And I didn't want to go through all those details because I really would have to do a handout and give it to you of all the different little battles and the intrigues that went back and forth that were prophesied in advance. And God, who the Bible says, like twice in the Bible, who cannot lie, he gave the details before they actually happened and left it to man to look at the history and see if it was not fulfilled as he said it would be. In verse 21, we see the individual who would be Antiochus Epiphanes is prophesied. He comes in peaceably and takes over the kingdom with intrigue. He was not the rightful heir to the Seleucid Empire, but he was able to take it over and get it when it was not his to have. That's usually the way it happens, isn't it? When you drop down to verse 31, here is the abomination of desolation. And it's called that right there. And it took place in 168 B.C. and lasted to 165 before the Maccabees were able to conquer and cleanse the temple and remove the statue of Jupiter Olympus out of the temple building, remove all of the swine's flesh was being offered on the outdoor altar in front of the temple building itself. That's where the sacrifices take place. That is one thing to keep in mind. It's hard to envision or that there's going to be a third temple actual building built. I won't say it could not be, but it does not say in the Olivet prophecies that there is an actual building. The prophecy talks about the evening and morning sacrifices. Now, they are done out in the open air on the altar, which is rather tall, setting in front of the building. Now, if you were to build a building right now, you'd probably have World War III breakout because the Dome of the Rock is sitting on the foundation stone of the Holy of Holies. And that's the only place it could you could build that temple. Now, to do that, you're going to have to remove it. And imagine what's going to happen if that should take place. Now, where are they going to have the altar? Because that's what is needed. Another point on that is that at the second temple, when the Jews came back from Babylon after the captivity, they started the temple and then they stopped. But they had built the altar in front of where the building behind, which was nothing more than foundation, sat, and they carried out evening and morning sacrifices on the altar, but no temple behind it. And, of course, Zechariah and Haggai came back, and they just, were livid. Why have you let this be like this, And it took them another 5 years to finish the building. But the point is that the evening and morning sacrifices can go on and did go on without the temple building standing. I kind of think, and maybe I'm wrong, that when Christ returns and he builds the temple, that's the third temple. Maybe I'm wrong. If they do build one, then what Christ would build would be the fourth temple. But the number three has more significance than number four. That's why I've sort of personally thought that that's what it's going to be. But again, that's my thought. And I've also, as I mentioned to some of you in the past, if you go to the Olivet Prophecy, I might have time to turn over to it here as we go forward in chapter 12. When you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to, Mark chapter 13, verse 14, where's that? Where it ought not to. He didn't say standing in the temple. And he did mention in Matthew's account the abomination of desolation. He mentioned temple. Maybe I'll turn to that a little bit later. But when you look at it more carefully, you have an article there in the Greek translated the. It also can be translated a temple. Which is it? We'll just have to wait and see. Also to keep in mind, in the Bible, when it talks about going up to the temple in the hour of prayer, they didn't go into the temple because they couldn't. only the priest could go into the first room, high priest into the Holy of Holies second room on the Day of Atonement. So what does it mean when they went up to the temple in the hour of prayer? Well, that was 3 p.m, I believe. The whole Temple Mount had portico buildings all the way around it. At Ambassador College, we had prayer closets. They had all these things around where they could come up on the Temple Mount. That was going to the temple. They were in the presence of the temple on the Temple Mount. They weren't in the building. They wouldn't be allowed to do that. So they could come up there. The Jews could, not the Gentiles, but the Jews could come up into the Temple Mount area. Now, isn't it ironic? Palestinians control the Temple Mount today, and the Jews can't go up on the Temple Mount. The former mayor of Jerusalem, was it Teddy Kollek? Not Teddy Kollek, it was after him, started the Enfatada when he did go up there and said, there's no reason for us to not, we have a right to that Temple Mount. He went up there and it started a war with the Palestinians over it and all of that. Well, it'd be interesting to see how this is all going to play out, but I pray that it's from a safe distance. If we're alive at that time. All right, let's get back here now to chapter 11. I said the abomination of desolation is in verse 31. Several things that are mentioned from 32 to 35 could apply to the church. If you look at it, let me read that. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. Antiochus Epiphanes did that to the Jews. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Great exploits is italicized. It's been added. What was the intention there? I'm not sure whether that's the correct intention by the writer or not. I kind of look at that last part, but the people who know their God shall be strong. Is that the Jewish people or is that the spiritual Jews? And at the later time. Verse 33, and those of the people who understand. Did the Jews understand? Understand what? Are we talking about spiritual truths? Who understand shall instruct many. And for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now, it could be a dualism there. The Jews who held to the Jewish culture, they instructed and taught others, and they, in many cases, died for it, too. but the term, the people who understand shall instruct many. Could that not also be the church through the ages that does understand as God opens up the knowledge of the prophecies to the church in various ages? To what would you do with it? You would teach it. Did Paul teach the book of Daniel? Sure did. Read what? 1 Thessalonians chapter 6 and verses 5 and 6. He says, I don't need to repeat all of this to you, which I gave to you before. And he was, where did he come up with 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the man of perdition, the man of sin? Book of Daniel. Book of Daniel, the little horn. He understood. He was living during the Roman Empire. And he probably was thinking it was 10 Caesars and not realizing it's going to be destroyed and it's going to come back up 10 times before Christ returns. Verse 34, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. That could be indeed have something to do with the Maccabees. It took a while for people to decide whether they would side with them and support them and go to battle with them to overthrow the Seleucids. Verse 35, and some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white. Now that almost sounds like Christians. Sounds like in the time of the end, those who maybe had compromised for a while on their beliefs in order to save their lives, or fearing for their lives that they did, it could be, and refine, purge, but to make them white, that is a term used in relation to conversion and the Holy Spirit, not just to a physical nation like the Jews in 168 B.C., until the time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. And you find this appointed time five times in the book of Daniel. Now, verses 36 through 39 is a kind of like a transition, and it's really more predominantly leaves Antiochus entirely behind and goes to the beast at the time of the end. And we'll see here. Verse 36, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. Now, Antiochus, of course, he tried to inculcate the Greek gods into the Jewish culture. But this individual is going to magnify himself above every god. Now, Antiochus magnified himself above the God of the Jews, the true God, but not above the gods that he had of his own culture. In fact, he wanted those gods to be worshipped. Excuse me. Jupiter Olympus was put into the temple. Verse 37, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above them all. I don't think this fits Antiochus in any way. This fits somebody that's yet to come. And exactly what do you mean, the desire of women? One thing was pointed out in one of the commentaries about Antiochus was that whether this is correctly rendered here into the English, nor the desire of women. He didn't regard women with much. I mean, he treated them like they were prostitutes. He would have them and get rid of them very quickly. It was, he didn't, in that sense, have any regard for women other than to use them. he shall regard neither the God of his fathers. Antiochus did regard the God of his fathers and set up the Greek gods. That was not something he did not do. This individual that we're talking about here obviously is the one yet to come. How that's going to exactly play out, it's hard to say yet. We'll just have to wait and see. For he shall magnify himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, which we believe is Satan the devil, and a god which his fathers did not know he shall honor with gold, silver, with precious stones, and pleasant things. Now, this individual is not going to come from one of the divisions of the broken-up Greek Empire. This individual, Antiochus, was a type of the one in the end who will come from the fourth kingdom. The fourth kingdom in which the little horn, and we specifically believe that, it, as the book of Revelation shows, that this person called, there are two beasts in the book of Revelation, chapter 13. One political, one religious. And you have to wonder, is the political beast, most specifically being referred to here, is he giving all of this silver, precious stones, and pleasant things to the little horn, to the other beast, the religious beast? I don't know what else to make, but it probably will turn out to be the case. Well, let's say, how would you understand that if that were not the case? I mean, well, then who's he giving it to? And if he's not giving it to his partner, if you will, to try to simplify the language, the partner's going to get jealous, right? You're giving it all to whoever. You're not giving it to me. And that's what I would think, or it would be where the wealth is going. And if I'm wrong, we'll see that in time. It won't be something that will cause us to stumble, I don't think. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. So he will be doing this. Now, change here. We have in verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, and with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through them. They'll be He'll be so strong that they cannot resist him. He'll just pass right through. Now, the king of the south, historically, was, of course, the Ptolemies of Egypt, and the king of the north was, historically, the Seleucids of Syria and parts to the east. But they came, and they were both conquered by the fourth kingdom, Rome. Rome, under the beginning of the Caesars, not Julius, but Mark Antony and who was the other one, Augustus, they all, I'd have to go back and get my history, but they absolutely walked over the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemy Empire of Egypt. But now we're talking about the time of the end, aren't we, here in verse 40. Who is the king of the south, or something of the king of the south in that spirit at the time of the end? I think I've, a couple times in the past on prophecy, I've used quotes from Dory Gold's book. What's the name of the book? I forgot it now. He was the former ambassador of Israel to the United Nations. He quotes from the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood. And they spoke on Al Jazeera and were very open about it. They made several interesting quotes that he has in the book that I read to you. One of them was, the gateway to Jerusalem is through Cairo. Once you control Cairo, you can take over Jerusalem. The other thing he said, his name was Zawari. I think he is now over Al-Qaeda. He was second in command to Osama bin Laden. They haven't caught him yet, by the way. He is number two, and they're looking, and he's Egyptian. He's also Muslim Brotherhood. But he said that the Muslim Brotherhood and the movement that he's behind must attack Rome and Istanbul. Why? Those two, the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, to destroy those religions. Now, if they ever, now we know, of course, Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood have been overthrown in Egypt by the military. What can we say about that? Is it because it's not yet the appointed time? Maybe. I would not take my eyes off of Egypt because Egypt does play a big role in prophecy at the time of the end, and they may indeed be the country of the king of the south. We'll just have to wait and see. But five times in this book of Daniel, it's at the appointed time. Now, it may not yet be quite the appointed time for the Brotherhood to control Egypt and its military. We'll see. But if Zawari was able, or those who would follow him, to carry out that threat, which they openly made, to attack the Vatican, would that be an attack against the King of the North? Most certainly would be. Now, what would the Europeans do if something like that happened? Just sit by? Well, we need to see if we can negotiate here. That would really stir some things up, to say the very least. Well, what are they going to do when it happens here? How soon afterwards? Will it be an immediate counterattack? Or will some years go by? I don't know. Verse 41, he shall also enter the glorious land, the king of the north. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now, why are those three escaping? Because he conquers the glorious land. You notice how things have to change, because you think the state of Israel is going to let the king of the north just walk in? They are an extremely powerful nation, and they are not, I don't believe, at least at this point in time, a nation that's going to be caught off guard. It doesn't mean that in the future they might go to sleep, but it sure seems unlikely, doesn't it? Something has to change. Well, who's this Edom and Moab and Ammon? Well, these are nations today which basically are made up of what we call the Palestinian people, Jordanian people. Many of the Jordanians recognize that their descendancy comes from Ammon and Moab. Who's Edom? Where's Edom at today? You have such a mixture of people there. And yet these people, which are right next to the Jewish people, they escape everything. How did they escape that? Verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Well, look at that. Egypt's not going to escape. And, of course, when he counterattacks, you never read about the king of the south ever again. He's finished. That's it. There is no king of the south after he counterattacks. This is why Mr. Armstrong thought in the Second World War, early years of the war, that this was the time of the end at that time. Why? Because he saw Rommel in the news crossing North Africa, heading toward the Suez Canal and the Glorious Land. And so he was predicting that the time is coming that Christ is going to return, that this was indeed it. And this is because he read this and he looked at the news. Well, then when he realized that wasn't going to happen after the British stopped Rommel, and then invaded Sicily and into Italy and everything, then realized, as especially when Germany was destroyed, preached on the radio that Germany will rise again. People laughed at him, but it wasn't long into the 50s it was becoming apparent that he was right. The Marshall Plan helped to rebuild all of the destroyed cities of Germany, and today, of course, it's the major nation in Europe when it comes to prosperity, wealth, and strength. Overall, verse 43, he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also, the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Now, those are strategic areas. North Africa, the Libyans, Ethiopians, the Red Sea, and the controlling of the Horn of Africa. Very strategic. It's not just an accident that he is going in those directions. But news from the east and the north, there is no word in Hebrew for northeast, so that's how you have to say it, shall trouble him, therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and to annihilate many. And of course he's going to, what's going to come out from the north and from the east? Well, we go to the book of Revelation and we begin to see that an army of 200 million is coming from the north and the east. And he goes out to meet him at Armageddon in the Valley of Megiddo, where many more wars have been fought in the Valley of Megiddo than any other location in man's history. And one big one is going to be fought there. It won't be the last one. I am assuming that he is probably going to lose up there and fall back to Jerusalem. The final battle is where? In the Kidron Valley. And Jesus Christ will come down to the Mount of Olives. It will split open. And he will annihilate the armies that are about to destroy life on the earth in that final battle there in Jerusalem. And that he will end, they talked about World War I being the war to end all wars. No, it's the one that's coming. Jesus Christ will fight in the war that will end all wars and with victory. Verse 45, and he shall plant the tents, that is, this individual will plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, Jerusalem. Yet he shall come to an end, and no one will help him. Again, back to the ending of Daniel chapter 2, where without hands he will be destroyed, human hands. All right, now chapter 12, let me get into this. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the archangel Michael, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And now, where have you read that before? Matthew 24, Jesus Christ quotes this. Matthew 24, 21. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book of life. They have the Spirit of God. That's what got their names put into the book of life. It is the Spirit of God received upon repentance, baptism, and the laying on of hands. And as long as we are faithful in doing the things that we should and continuing to be, now some people, of course, may be less faithful than they should be, and God will allow certain trials to come to wake them up. But if we are being faithful and doing everything we can, our names will remain in that book of life. Hold your place here, and let's go over to Isaiah 26. Isaiah 26, interesting couple things here that Isaiah had that fall right in line with the verse I just read. I'm going to start in verse 19. You might see, if you have a subheading added by the publishers above chapter 26, it says a song of salvation, and it is. It's a summary that they have given. It was not in the Hebrew, but that's good. It gives you a kind of a summation of what's being covered in the chapter. Verse 2 and 3, or 3 and 4, talking there about faith. You will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you because he trusts in you. Very good scripture that can strengthen us and help us through many difficulties and trials. Trust in the Lord forever, for in Yah, the Lord, is everlasting strength. There's something that we can really bite our teeth into, so to speak. But now let's drop down to verse 19. Your dead shall live. Well, that's the resurrection, isn't it? Together with my dead body, who are we talking about here? Christ. They shall arise, awake and sing, you who dwell in dust, for your dust is like the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead by the resurrection. Verse 20. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation is past. What is it? Well, tribulation and abomination of desolation and all that will go with it. For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. And the earth will also disclose her blood and will no more cover her slain. He's coming to punish. Yes, he is. The book of Revelation says that's what Jesus Christ is going to do first thing when he returns. Back here to Daniel chapter 12. Verse 2, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, this verse seems to be quoted by Christ in Matthew 5, verse 28. Matthew 5, 28. I use it in funerals. Other ministers do too, because it says there in Matthew 5, 28, that all will be resurrected, some unto everlasting life and some unto everlasting, it says, contempt, but it should be judgment. Other translation says unto everlasting damnation. That is incorrect. It is judgment. And the second resurrection is a resurrection of judgment. And you and I are in a resurrection of judgment preceding the resurrection. We're under judgment now. When the first resurrection comes, of course, our judgment will be over. But our lives, when we're called in this age, are being presently judged by what's written in these books. Verse 3, those who are wise shall shine. That's the saints, those who have God's Spirit. Like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. The energy that our old sickly bodies are in right now, after all the years of our lives, we're finding out, most of us who have been around quite a while, how puny we really are. And it's only a matter of time before the body runs out of any energy at all. And but what he is saying here is, Jesus used the analogy of light versus darkness. The light is so strong, the energy is so great, you cannot look at Christ without and live. And we're going to be like him. We're going to be like him. That's hard to believe, because all we know is we look at each other and we see our weaknesses, we see our aging, we see all of those things. But to live forever and ever and be like the stars that seem to burn forever and ever, or at least certainly that was used because the writers and people who read this and originally understood that they were just forever up there. And but great energy, great power that is hard to even describe. Paul said we look through a glass darkly. It's hard to understand something like that. Verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end, and many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Knowledge shall increase. I was telling people, and I've told you too, but I was mentioning it here in Miami this morning, we take for granted the incredibleness of knowledge that has taken place since, you can go back to the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. You can go back 20 years ago. You can go back to the end of World War II and coming forward. Man has developed and learned so much in knowledge of everything that it's just incredible. Now, this word, knowledge shall increase. I had a member over there in Miami told me the Greek word for increase, not the Greek, the Hebrew word there means explosion. There will be an explosion of knowledge. And that really does, I think, paint the picture more vivid to us. I saw, was it earlier this week, on either History or Discovery, one of those channels, about Thomas Edison, J.P. Morgan, and Tesla. We have alternating current from Tesla. But J.P. Morgan originally backed Edison and direct current. And then when he saw that Edison was not going to prevail, he let him go and went with Tesla. Interesting. But what was interesting to me is being pointed out in that program what the harnessing of electricity meant for mankind. It's an incredible thing. If the Apostle Paul was in this room today, he would probably be staring at some of these things, looking at these lights, wondering, how do you do that? things we take for granted. couldn't you imagine the fascination, the interest, as those were people who certainly were interested in new things, learning things, just like we are, to walk around and look at things, looking at the building materials in this building, looking at all the incredible things, going down a freeway, looking at one of the interchanges over there in Miami, of all the bridges crisscrossing over, and just it's an incredible thing to look at. We take it for granted, don't we? To see an airplane approaching the airport out here. You never know. He might rebuke a demon saying that. He wouldn't know any better. many incredible things. No, I don't think he would. He would know it was the time of the end. There wouldn't be any question in his mind or John's mind, who wrote the book of Revelation. He'd probably say, I saw that. I saw those things. But when Jesus inspired this for Daniel to write it, that knowledge shall explode. And when you have an explosion, it goes everywhere, doesn't it? All directions. Every area of science and technology, there is an explosion of knowledge. And so if anybody doubts that we're in the time of the end, they, well, maybe, oh, you got long. I don't know how much longer we have to go. I don't think it's tomorrow. How long is the time of the end? Only God knows. But I am absolutely convinced, anyone who has eyes to see, reads scriptures like this and looks around them, it is the time of the end. But the length of the time of the end is in God's hands, isn't it? Well, how long has the time of the end been going on? You know, you go back here, look at Edison and the... you not only have electricity, you have the combustion engine and all of that at the turn of the century, aircraft in its very infancy, to say the least. It was slow up to the Second World War. Then things began to really increase. The jet engines came along. Things began to mushroom, didn't it? And new knowledge was coming on. And of course, the computer, space, on and on and on. Technology, the things. You get your little iPads and things with you, your phones and all these. I don't know how to use those things. I know some of you do. I know how to use a phone, but all the different applications that are in these things, incredible. Yeah, see, George, it makes you look smart. And but, I mean, when you think about it, something like that, well, that's incredible. Wouldn't it be something if Peter were standing here and, George, you come up and show Peter how to run that thing? Come up and show me first. No. Well, let me move on here to finish here on time. But this has always been a fascinating statement at the end of verse 4 to me. Knowledge shall increase. It actually should be knowledge shall explode, because that's exactly what it means. Verse 5, then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this riverbank, the other on that riverbank. Could either be a canal or it could be the Euphrates, either way. And one said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Then I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river. And when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever, this is how long it will be, he says, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Now, this apparently is applying to the Jewish people in Jerusalem at that time, and I'll show you a little bit. I mentioned earlier at the beginning the numbers, 1260, 3.5. Another one I didn't say, but I'll throw out at this time, is 42 months. Now, hold your place here. Let's go to Revelation 12 and take a look and see if we can't put these numbers together. The time, times, and half a times can be 3.5 years, 3.5 days, not 3.5 days, 3.5 years, or 1,260 years. Here in Revelation 12:6, it's 1,260 years. Revelation 12:6, the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a, the woman is the church, has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days or 1,260 years. A day is as a year. Now, if you drop down to chapter 13, verse 5, talking about the beast, in verse 5, and he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. 42 months. Now look up at chapter 12 again, verse 14. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. Now, what do these all have in common? The 1260, the three, the time, times, and half a time. The 1260 is 42 months. It's divisible by what? 30. So you have 42 months in 1260 years. If it's a day is as a year, then it's obvious that we're looking at 3.5, as it talks about the church going into the wilderness. The church isn't going to, in verse 14, at the time of the end, to escape Satan the devil just before Christ returns. Going to be another 1,260 years until he comes back? They'd all be dead. So, no, they're going to still be alive at the end of that time and times and half a time at Christ's return, and then changed, resurrected at that time, or that is changed into from flesh to spirit. The point here is that we can understand what the time, times, coming back now to Daniel, the time, times, and half a times is talking about. It's talking about 3.5 years, or, if you look at the context, it's talking about 1,260 days, which are years. One other place here in Daniel 7, we see it. Verse 25 of Daniel 7. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. He is referring to the little horn, the religious horn or beast, found also in Revelation 13. Shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. And then the saints shall be given into his hand. How long? For a time, times, and half a time. Well, we know that the persecution historically throughout Europe against true saints lasted a good 1,260 years. many were put into the Inquisitions. Many of them faced martyrdom. Many of them were not true Christians. They just simply disagreed with the religious authorities. Others were, apparently, and only God knows their names. Now, coming back to finish chapter 12, Daniel asks, well, how long is this going to be? And in verse 7, the answer is 3.5 years. Now, how can I be sure of that? Because it starts in verse 1. if it was 1,260 years... well, there wouldn't be anything to come back to, would there? No, it's only going to be 3.5 years of the great tribulation here that we see in verse 1 that is described. Daniel's asking the, most likely it's Gabriel, how long will this be? And he tells him, three time, times, and half a time. I think Daniel could figure that one out because it has been used already once or twice previously in this book. Verse 8. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. And many shall be purified, made white, and refined. How? Through Christ and repentance, baptism. But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Why? Because they have God's Spirit and they believe what's written in the book. Verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away. Wait a minute. That's another abomination. We already finished it in chapter 11, right? Jesus was talking about this one right here in verse 11. He wasn't talking about the previous ones. They were forerunners, or it was a forerunner. Verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up again, there shall be 1,290 days. Now, wait a minute. Here we got 1,260, which is 3.5. What's this 1,290? Let's go on. Verse 12, blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335. Wow, what are these numbers? Well, let's start with the big one first. I can say this about, we have three sets of numbers here, 1,260 and verse 7. We have, that's what verse 7 is, a time, a half a time. We have 1,290 in verse 11, and we have 1,335 in verse 12. Verse 12 is 45 days longer than verse 11. And that would be 75 days longer than verse 7, right? Okay. Well, what the church has always understood is that all three end at the same time, the second coming of Christ. So, but that means then they don't all three start at the same time, do they? The 1,335 would begin first, followed by the 1,290, the 1,260, and they all end at the coming of Jesus Christ. Look at verse 12 again. Blessed is he who waits. Do you think that would be the wicked? Would that be the world? Who would be blessed who waits? And wait for what? How about waiting for Christ? Hold your place again, Revelation 3. Let's take a look here, church at Philadelphia. Interesting statement, chapter 3, verse 10, makes this point, if I can get there. Revelation 3:10, because you have kept my command to persevere. Now, the Authorized King James, I've always preferred the way it renders this verse 10. You have kept, because you have kept the word of my patience. If you, any of you have a King James, you'll see that's what it says. I think it even says it in the center margin here. I'm looking quickly and I can't pick it up. But anyhow, going back, I'm reading New King James. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial or tribulation which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. All right, now let's go back to chapter 12, verse 13, verse 12. Blessed is he who waits. Now he said to that church, because you have kept the word of my patience, you have persevered, you have been patient, I will keep you from the hour of tribulation. The hint seems to be clear. We have always believed it in all the 40 plus years I've been in the church. Verse 12 is referring to the church. And the difference of 45 days between that and the 12. All right, look at 12. Let's look at verse 11 again. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days until what? Christ returns. Until Christ returns. We have always thought, we can't say dogmatically, maybe there will be things to come along that would cause us to see it differently in the future. I don't know, but I haven't seen it in 40 plus years to see it any differently. That the church would go into its place of safety wherever that would be at the beginning of the 1,335. And they wait patiently for the return of Jesus Christ. That the nation, the glorious land of Judah and the nations of modern Israel would go into and begin to be destroyed, to go into tribulation at the beginning of the 1290. Now, why does it, we say that? Well, because that's when the abomination, the cutting off of the, when the, what am I trying to read? The abomination of desolation and the daily sacrifice is stopped. There will not be a modern state of Israel when that happens. It will have been defeated. For them, it is over until Christ returns. That's what we see here that's taking place. 30 days later, we see the 1260 begins. Now, the 1260 is the time of great tribulation, of which the last year of the great tribulation is called the day of the Lord. And ends, of course, with the coming of Jesus Christ. That is how we have understood that. I have not seen anything that would change our thinking at this time. I'm not saying that there might be some change, because it's hard to be totally dogmatic. We're looking at certain clues of words that are used there. And verse 12 does seem very, almost very clearly, that it is, has to be talking about the church. Nobody else is going to be blessed when you think about it. Only the church could be blessed, not the world, not the evil ones, not the, anyone else. So that seems most clear that it has to be the church there. So then you go back to verse 11. When the abomination of desolation takes place, you have the destruction of modern Israel and Judah at the same time going on. You have a war beginning, a destruction, and it will be followed after 30 days by 1260 days or 3.5 years of great tribulation. Verse 7, when Daniel said, how long is this going to be? Tribulation. And the abomination of desolation will last for 3.5 years. Then verse 13, but you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days. Daniel did not go to heaven. He's going to arise or be resurrected at the second coming of Christ, as we should understand. But this is a point to look at, because Jesus said, no man has gone to heaven. And certainly Daniel, who was a righteous man, did not go to heaven. He will arise with the rest of the saints to his inheritance at the second coming of Jesus Christ. Well, we will stop there and have a final song and prayer, and we'll continue in a different subject next month on the 19th of April.